Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau from Compassionate Cooks. I founded Compassionate Cooks to empower people to make informed food choices and to debunk myths about vegetarianism and animal rights. You can learn more about who we are and what we do by visiting our website, CompassionateCooks.com. And from there, you can check out our cookbook, The Joy of Vegan Baking, our cooking DVD, some articles and essays. You can join our message board, which is a great way to connect with other podcast listeners. So thank you for being here and for being interested in our podcast. Before we get started, I would like to thank today's sponsor, first and foremost, Brian Kubliska. It was actually Brian's brother, Mike, who made a gift sponsorship in Brian's name, which was very sweet and very generous. And when I wrote to Brian to notify him of his brother's gift, he wrote back to commend his brother for what he does. So here's what Brian wrote to me. Thank you so much for the email. It's very nice to hear from you. My brother is the one who truly deserves recognition for all of the work that he does for animal rights. He's a tireless volunteer with the organization SHARC, which is sharkonline.org. So Mike's sponsoring on behalf of Brian, and Brian is commending Mike for his work. So I just wanted to make sure each of them knew that each one of them has a lot of affection for the other, obviously, and it's very lovely. And Brian also went on to say that I'm a big fan of all the work you do, and I love your new cookbook. The pumpkin spice bread, the cornbread, and the chocolate cake were all a hit at my Christmas party for my non-vegan friends. They've all been introduced to the magic cake before, but the addition of peppermint and the frosting made it a hit. I truly enjoy everything that you produce in all of your writings and podcast and cookbook and DVD. Your compassion, caring, and enthusiasm comes through. Can anyone say quinoa? It makes me smile every time I prepare some. Thank you for all you do. I always seem to be a little more energized after listening to a podcast. Thank you, Brian. I really appreciate that. And thank you, Mike, for your sponsorship on behalf of your brother, Brian. And thank you for all you do as well. I'm very grateful to all of the podcast sponsors who provide the support necessary to do this podcast. I'm committed to giving you the best information and resources I can, and that takes a lot of time and research and resources. So if you glean anything at all from this podcast, I hope you will consider being a sponsor. You can make a one-time contribution, or you can become a monthly sponsor. You can just visit CompassionateCooks.com to make your choice. Thank you for any help you can provide. So I'd like to get to the topic at hand. I remember when I was a teenager, I don't remember how old I was exactly. I must have been 17 or so. I remember there was a leather store in the mall near where I lived, and it's probably still there. Leather store that sold everything from coats and belts and jackets and purses and wallets and whatever else, all made out of leather. And I remember saving up my money so that I could buy this long black leather skirt. And I think I even bought it on layaway. Remember layaway? Since I couldn't afford it all at once. And I really, really wanted that skirt. So I saved up and I bought the skirt and I wore the skirt and I loved the skirt. And I remember having a brown leather bomber jacket that I loved for years. And I had a favorite pair of boots, these cowboy boots that I had many, many moons ago. All leather, of course. And I loved these things. I absolutely loved them. And I had no idea what I was contributing to. I was someone who already cared about animals. I was not many years away from reading Diet for New America. I had already done some reading on animal issues, you know, animals in puppy mills and laboratories, and yet I had successfully compartmentalized my compassion, my understanding, and I was blissfully ignorant of the impact I was having. And I'm certain that when I stopped eating land animals, again, I couldn't call myself vegetarian. I was still eating aquatic animals, but I'm certain that I was still wearing these animals, the skins of these animals, even though I wasn't eating them. So I know that happens in a lot of cases where people become vegetarian. They're still eating dairy and eggs, etc., and they're not eating the land animals out of compassion for them, but they continue to wear them. And I know that happens a lot. You know, the power of denial is deep and it's vast and it's huge. And, you know, we're able to really compartmentalize this stuff. Even though we know we're eating a chicken leg, you know, that once belonged on someone's body, we're still able to separate it from that once living animal. Ditto for wings, you know, eating wings or backsides or breasts or wearing the skin. of an animal, we're really good at denying reality. And one of the ways we do this is through the excuses we need to tell ourselves in order to not only do what we do, but also to feel good about doing it, right? Most of us want to actually feel like we're doing something favorable. We want to be doing something positive. So we tell ourselves these excuses and we tell the world these excuses, not only so we can continue doing so, but so that we can continue feeling good about it. And I've talked a lot about the excuses people come up with for eating animals. And wouldn't you know, we've come up with a few excuses for wearing the skin of those animals too. The most common of which is leather is just a byproduct of the meat industry. At least they're doing something with the leftover parts of the animals instead of having it just go to waste. So let's address this idea that leather is just an innocent byproduct of the meat industry. There's a lot to say. First of all, the U.S. leather industry is a $1.5 billion business and tans over 100 million animal skins every year. That's a lot of animals. That's a lot of money. Worldwide, it's even bigger, and it's a huge booming industry. According to the World Trade Organization, the leather sector represents $46 billion, ranking among the most important internationally traded commodity. That's 18 billion square feet of leather a year, by the way. I thought it was kind of interesting to create a visual there. 18 billion square feet of leather every year. Now, what most people don't understand is that the meat industry is not sustainable on its own. It relies on skin sales to remain profitable. The meat industry needs the revenue from skin sales to stay in business. Let me put this another way. One of the reasons meat can be so cheap, besides the subsidies it receives from the government, is because the meat industry can sell so much of the other body parts of the animal, such as the skin, the fat, the liver, the hearts, all these edible and non-edible parts of the animal, for a profit. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the skin represents the most economically important byproduct of the meat packing industry. In fact, animal skins account for 55 to 60% of the byproduct value of cattle. In other words, the leather industry, the byproduct industry, essentially subsidizes the meat industry. At the same time, the leather industry is directly dependent on the meat industry, which is why it drives me crazy when people say, well, at least they're doing something with the rest of the animals. At least they're not wasting the rest of the animals. So the problem with that is to say that is to completely ignore the fact that the meat industry is not an innocuous industry. The leather industry does not exist in a moral vacuum. It's a business that exists to make money, as is the meat industry. The people in the leather industry, they're not in it because they're altruists. They didn't come up with this industry because they wanted to help reduce slaughterhouse waste. Okay, so let's just be clear about that. Let's not give credit to an industry that relies on the suffering and the death of billions of animals in order to make a pretty handsome profit. That's why they're in it. The meat industry, as you know, as you've heard, if you've listened to any other episodes on this podcast, is a terribly wasteful and cruel industry. So to support the leather industry is to support this wasteful and cruel industry. The leather industry is just as implicated in the killing of animals as is the meat industry. Because if the leather industry did not exist, providing profit for the meat industry, there would be a lot less incentive to kill so many animals. The worth of the animal sold is the worth of the whole animal, not just the meat. And if we stopped using leather products and buying products that have gelatin and all these other animal byproducts, the cost of meat would soar to an unattainable level for most people, effectively crippling the beef industry. So what I want to do first is kind of first look at the different types of leather. People kind of ask this question all the time. What's this kind? What's that type? And then I want to look at the animals themselves so you can get a sense of who's being killed and whose skins are being used for the leather industry. First of all, there's something called slink skins or slunk skins, and it's an industry term. The word slink means to bring forth young prematurely. So slink or slunk skins are from unborn or prematurely born calves. This is considered the softest of all leather. The label will most likely say calf leather. Many of us have seen that on labels, which doesn't seem to give people pause, even though they know that calves are babies. But it might give them pause to know that the skin is from babies who were calves, who were still inside their mothers when she was killed. All of these skins, and these skins are broken down into three categories. And they have a name for each one. There's skin that comes from early stage fetuses that has very, very short hair. There's skin that comes from medium stage fetuses with very short hair. There's skin that comes from late stage unborn calves with longer hair. And this is the case where, you know, certainly some animals who are born or born stillborn, and they use the skin of those animals. But you have to consider the dairy industry is producing all of these calves. Some of these babies come from the dairy industry, and some come from the fact that dairy cows, as you know, are killed at the end of their quote-unquote production cycle. And so they often have a calf inside of them when they're killed. And that baby is used for the leather industry as well. And this skin of calves is very highly prized because it's very soft and very pliable, and people like that soft, or have been taught to like that soft skin, that soft leather. Now, slink skin isn't only from calves. It can also refer to the skin of other stillborn or aborted babies, including lambs. So that's slink skin, calf skin. Buckskin, you've heard of buckskin. It's also called brained leather. It's a tanning process that uses animal brains or other fatty materials, including egg yolks, to alter the leather. And it can be made from any hooved animal, mostly from deer. And if you haven't figured it out by now, if you hear that word buckskin, the word buck as a slang for dollar comes from the fact that buckskin was a unit of trade among Indians and Europeans during the frontier days, and that word has obviously carried on to today. Patent leather is just a leather that's been given a high gloss finish. It usually has a plastic coating that's patent leather. Rawhide is a very tough kind of leather. It refers to a particular tanning process. It tends to be used for drum making or lampshades or snowshoe webbing. Vellum, you've probably heard of. Vellum or parchment tend to be used interchangeably. Originally, vellum was prepared from the skins of stillborn animals. Sometimes goat skin or sheepskin was used. And besides being used for writing, vellum or parchment was used to make drumheads and lampshades. In the late 19th century, though, a paper product with properties similar to vellum was created. And that's a good thing because it's just paper. They just treat and emboss wood pulp or cotton fiber. And so you'll see that called vellum paper, imitation vellum, vegetable vellum or Japanese vellum, and it's available today. It's what you can find in paper stores. But the pages of ancient and rare antique books were most likely made from the skins of calves. And in fact, many of those books were also bound using not only animal skin, obviously, but interestingly enough, human skin was used as well. Books were bound in human skin for a long time. This practice even has a name among academics. It's called anthropodermic bibliopagy, and it's been practiced for a long time. It largely disappeared by the 18th century, but some examples of books bound in human skin can be seen on display in museums around the world. They also appear in private collections, obviously. And skin for binding books typically came from executed criminals. The first known example of this was the binding of Samuel Johnson's dictionary in the skin of criminal James Johnson. I don't believe there was a relation after the latter was hanged in 1818. There's also a book in a museum in Suffolk, England, and it contains a more famous example. There was an account of the trial proceedings against a man named William Corder, who was responsible for the murder of Maria Martin. And so there's a book about this murder called Murder in the Red Barn, and in 1827, and that book is bound in the executed murderer's skin. So it's a very famous example of that. Skin from cadavers used in anatomy labs was also used, as well as the skin of people who wanted their skin used after they died to bound books. There are several instances of people who asked that their skin be used after they died and their wishes were granted. And I wonder if people thought they were crazy the way people think Ingrid Newkirk is crazy for doing the same thing. I wonder if you've heard about this. Ingrid Newkirk, who's the co-founder and the head of PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, has infamously requested in her will that her body be used after she dies to call attention to needless animal suffering. And in her will, she suggests a number of things in terms of each part of her body being used for a particular purpose. And she suggests, quote, that my skin or a portion thereof be removed and made into leather products, such as purses, to remind the world that human skin and the skin of other animals is the same, and that neither is fabric nor needed. And of course, people are, you know, calling her crazy and nutty, and it's just a publicity stunt. Well, it is a publicity stunt because she's doing this to call attention to animal suffering. But what's interesting is that though her motivations are certainly different, this is not so different from people a couple centuries ago who asked that their skin be used as leather when they die. Now, the known examples indicate that people were doing it for posterity or even out of romance. There's a couple instances that it's very interesting. but Ingrid's doing it to make a point about our use and abuse of animals. And I think that's one of the reasons people have a problem with it. I think they also have a problem with it because most of us, you know, have kind of accepted animal skin and leather. It doesn't really faze us at all. But when we consider something being made of human skin, even though it's true, we are just another kind of animal, we're kind of freaked out about that. So it's just something to ponder. It's worth saying at this point, by the way, just because I wonder if people are thinking about this, the idea that Nazis were using the skin of their victims to make lampshades has really been kind of debunked. There were probably a couple isolated incidents, but there's a famous film of a lampshade of that was apparently, allegedly made from human skin, and apparently it's really never been proven. So that's why I didn't bring that up when I talked about human skin. Of course, that's very disturbing to think about, but it looks like that was really a myth. No one's been able to really find documentation and proof of that. So, but we do get kind of disturbed, especially in a case like the Holocaust. Obviously, that's a very particular example. But like I said, people were doing this out of their own request, out of their own desire to have their skin be preserved after they died. Now, moving on, suede leather is made from the underside of the animal's skin, primarily lamb, but goat and pig and calf and deer are also used to make suede leather. Shearling, contrary to what many people think, is not sheared wool. The term refers to a yearling lamb who has been shorn once. A yearling is an animal who's in his first year of life, and a shearling, get it, a yearling. Shearling garment is made from the skin of a lamb who has been shorn just shortly before slaughter, and the skin is tanned with the wool still on it. I have a Flickr page that has pictures of me with different animals, and there's a photo of me with some baby lambs who had just been dumped at Farm Sanctuary. This was in the New York shelter, and they were being treated by the staff at the farm. So I was hanging out with these baby lambs, and it was freezing there in New York in November. So I was wearing my winter coat, and someone saw this photo on Flickr and commented that it was odd that I was wearing a shearling coat while I was petting the lambs. So for the record, I was not wearing a shearling coat. I don't own a shearling coat. Whatever it is, it's cotton or some other materials, but I assure you it was not made from lambs. But I thought that was pretty funny that they saw that and thought, oh my gosh, you're petting lambs and you're wearing lambs. But we do that all the time, don't we? We really kind of, when you look at the world through that lens, you can really recognize the strangeness of it all, the hypocrisy of it all. Okay, so those are just the different types of leather, and lots of different animals are used for leather, obviously, and we'll talk about some of the common ones that tend to be used mostly in the U.S. First of all, from the meat industry, there are bulls and steers. These are the largest animals with the toughest skins, and the skin is prized. It's very tough. It's very thick, and they tend to be used for leather a lot. Bulls have the thickest skin, and as I said, the calves have the softest skin. The bull's skin tends to be used for the soles of shoes, And the young calves are used for their skin as well. Now, dairy cows, as you know, are killed at the end of their production cycle. And I say that in quotes because it's really the end of their profitability cycle. When they can't produce enough milk to justify spending money to keep them alive, they're killed for their meat and they're killed for their skin. And these cows are killed whether they're pregnant or not, as I said earlier, and the dead calves are taken from their mothers' mutilated bodies, and they're used to make soft leather. So mother and baby both used for leather. Again, the economic success of slaughterhouses and dairy farms are directly linked to the sale of leather goods. It's all intricately, kind of intertwined. Pigskin is used in apparel. And it's also used in saddles, like horse saddles. Early footballs used to be made from the skin of pig, so that's why that word still applies. People tend to call a football a pigskin. And it seems that the skin of cattle are mostly used these days for footballs, but also early on, footballs were basically inflated pig's bladders. That's what they used as the balls, so that's one of the reasons why people still call it pigskin. I've mentioned lambs and sheep, but even more prized for their skin than these animals are goats. In fact, the skins of baby goats are highly prized for their softness as well, just as that from baby lambs and baby calves. And of course, you've heard the phrase kid gloves, which refers to the fact that gloves owe their softness to the fact that they're made from the skin of baby goats. Kids, they're called kids. Now, I've seen some people claim that goats are boiled alive to make kid gloves, but I couldn't document this myself. I couldn't prove this myself, so I can't say whether it's true or not. But the fact is, the slaughter industry is a brutal one, and one that relies on the speed of the slaughterhouse workers to be as quick as possible. So, just in the routine operations of a typical slaughterhouse, many animals are indeed boiled alive as well as skinned alive. So, even though I couldn't prove that to make kid gloves, baby goats are boiled alive, it's something that happens routinely every day anyway. Now, horses are killed for human consumption, as you know, but they're also used for human transportation, novelty rides, horse racing. As you remember from the Burden of Burros episode, wild horses are rounded up and slaughtered to make room for cattle grazing. But so horses are used also for their leather. Apparently, baseball leather is the leather used to cover baseballs. And prior to 1974, baseballs were covered in cowhide. Today, baseballs are covered in horse hide. And in fact, the Major League Baseball rulebook has guidelines for the construction of a baseball. And it says very specifically, that the ball shall be a sphere formed by yarn, wound around a small core of cork and rubber and similar material, covered with two stripes of white horse hide or cowhide, tightly stitched together. So they're still using animals. Cordovan, you may have heard of, is a kind of leather made from horses. It's specifically from the part of their body and their backside, a very tight part of their backside. So those are the animals that we use that's from the slaughter industry. Horses are kind of an exception because technically, it's illegal to slaughter horses in the United States, although it is done. But those are all the slaughter-related animals. And even though the slaughter industry relies on the leather industry to be profitable, that doesn't mean other animals are safe. Quite the contrary. Some animals in the U.S., such as deer, sharks, and alligators, were killed just for their skins. And animals killed outside the U.S., killed just for their skins, include zebras, bison, water buffaloes, kangaroos, elephants, eels, dolphins, seals, walruses, frogs, crocodiles, and lizards. Apparently, snake skin comes from snakes that have been skinned alive. Apparently, there's a belief that the lifeblood in the skin keeps the skin supple until tanning. Alligators, in fact, they are killed in the wild, but they are also factory farmed for their skins and their meat. Young alligators are often kept in tanks above ground, and then the bigger animals live in pools or are kept in pools that are half sunken into concrete slabs. PETA has information about this on their website, and this is from their website. According to Florida's regulations, as many as 350 6-foot alligators can legally inhabit a space the size of a typical family home. One Georgia farmer had 10,000 alligators living in four buildings, where hundreds and hundreds of alligators filled every inch of each room, according to the Los Angeles Times. Although alligators may naturally live up to 60 years, farmed alligators are usually butchered before the age of 2, as soon as they reach 4 to 6 feet in length. Humane treatment is not a priority for those who poach and hunt animals to obtain their skin or those who transform skin into leather. Alligators on farms may be beaten to death with hammers and axes, sometimes remaining conscious and in agony for up to 2 hours after they are skinned. Now, one pretty big campaign in Australia. I'm not sure if you've heard about it for those who are here in North America. Australia exports approximately 3 million kangaroo skins every year. And the vast majority of these skins are used to make soccer shoes or football shoes for those in the UK. And some are used for golf gloves, baseball mitts, and other sports goods. Now, you won't see kangaroo on the label, but you will see K leather, or RKT, which stands for Rubberized Kangaroo Technology. Each year, the Australian government sets a quota for the number of kangaroos the industry can kill. In 2007, the quota was 3.8 million kangaroos. 2003 saw the highest quota ever set, ever, at 6.9 million. And apparently, a majority of the kangaroos shot, I've seen numbers at 50%, I've seen up to 80% of the kangaroos shot are female, especially at this point, since they've been shooting so many that all who remain are the females because they've already shot the largest males. So many of these females have joeys, one or two joeys. Joeys are baby kangaroos in their pouch, called in pouch or at foot, which means that they're old enough to be out of the pouch, but they're still young and they depend on their mother to teach them how to survive. And when their mother is shot, sometimes the joeys at foot will hop off in fear and they will often die a very slow death because they don't know how to survive in the wild without their mothers. And for those who don't run off or who are still in pouch, the Australian government has devised an approved method, quote unquote, of killing a joey at foot or in pouch. One way is to bash him over the head with a heavy object, and the other is to chop off his or her head with an axe. This is written into the code of practice for the humane killing of kangaroos. And now, what's interesting, like I said, is that this is done for the skin of the animals. People don't eat kangaroo meat. The attempts to promote kangaroo meat in the United Kingdom failed because of widespread publicity about the cruelty and also because of the health risks that kangaroo meat carries, high burdens of internal abdominal and muscular parasites. So this is a case where the butchering of wild animals is done solely for their skin. And if it sounds familiar, it is, right? We know this is the case with the baby harp seals who are being killed for the same reason in Canada for their fur. And what I really want to do is recommend an organization that you can check out, you can get involved with if you are in Australia, or even if you're not. There's still other things you can do, including supporting this organization. There's the National Kangaroo Protection Coalition. I will have the link up on the message board, and I'll also make sure it's up on my website, but it's kangaroo-protection-coalition.com. But again, I'll have it up on my website, or you can even type in National Kangaroo Protection Coalition, and it's an alliance of Australian and other wildlife and animal protection groups who are trying to close down this commercial and non-commercial kangaroo kill. So they're a fantastic group of people who are involved doing this, and I encourage you to check them out and to help if you can. Now, I don't have to go through all the ways in which the meat industry in the US and elsewhere perpetuates the most unthinkable cruelty. Just listen to any of the podcast episodes about the various animals killed for human consumption, and you'll get the idea. But I want to point this out first and foremost. As I said earlier, the meat industry is cruel and wasteful and kills 10 billion animals in the US every year for naught. For naught. We have no need to consume the flesh of animals or drink their fluids. So these animals are bred, they suffer, they're killed for nothing. So when people have this attitude, well, at least leather is just a byproduct, implying that animals are not killed just for their skin, and we know that in many cases they are, but what they're also implying is that the meat industry is just some necessary and incidental industry that exists without, our being able to do anything about it. And that's not the case. So finding a use for something like, I don't know, like human hair, if there's excess human hair at hair salons, right? That would be a good instance of an industry growing out of that. Because look, we cut our hair. It's wasteful to just throw all that hair away if something can be done with it. So that would be an example where, hair cut from salons would be an innocuous industry, an innocuous product. And we would just, oh, that's really neat that people are trying to do something with that excess product. But excess skin from slaughterhouses is far from harmless. It's far from innocuous. So let's not mistake the leather industry for an innocent industry that's making the best use of something that would otherwise go to waste. The meat industry has created an artificial system of life and death. The animals killed are not incidental deaths. In order to look at the cruelties of the leather industry, you have to look at the cruelties of the meat and the dairy industries because they're inherently linked. But let's look at some other problems with the leather industry. One of the things that happens when you buy leather products, you don't exactly know what type of animal was killed, as if that makes any difference, but still. And you also may not know where that animal came from or how he or she suffered or was killed and processed. The US slaughter industry is bad. It's full of violence, it's full of loopholes and cruelty. But as bad as the US slaughter industry is, it's not as bad as those in most other countries, especially developing countries. And so, what you have to consider when you consider the leather industry is that the animals are killed in one place, in many places. They come from many different countries, right? And so, when they skin them and kill them there, and who knows what the slaughter standards are and the welfare standards, where they're minimal at best. So when you wear a leather belt or a leather jacket or have a leather purse or wear leather shoes, you have no idea where that animal came from and how he was treated. And I can assure you that he was not treated with kindness. I'll give you one example. Indian leather. Much of the leather sold in the US comes from overseas, especially from India and China. India is one of the leaders in the global leather industry. If you haven't seen the PETA investigation of cattle, of this Indian cattle industry, you might want to check it out to become more informed. Many people mistakenly believe that cows are treated well in India because they're revered by some, but not all Indians are Hindu, and even those who are against using cattle for meat, they're not against using cattle for other things. And look, hypocrisy exists everywhere. Hypocrisy exists in India just as it exists everywhere else. And it should surprise you that the leather industry in India is one of the largest in the world. But it's not that cattle can't be killed in India. It's that they can't be killed in certain areas, certain provinces, certain states. And that doesn't mean that you can't raise cattle in those areas where they can't be killed. So what happens is the cattle are raised in one area, but since they can't kill them in that same area, obviously they have to transport them to another area to be killed. And these cattle are forced to travel hundreds of miles on foot. Their noses are tied together, they're in the hot sun, and they travel to these provinces where they can be killed. Now, they travel a great distance on foot, and then they're loaded onto transport trains or trucks, and then they're sent off to slaughter. And that image of animals marching to their own death is something that's very unsettling for me. I just have this image of them marching to their slaughter, and I find that very disturbing. So the PETA investigation revealed the following. During the trip, cattle, buffaloes, and other animals killed for their skin travel on foot without food and water, with minimal time to rest. Their hooves are often bleeding and worn down to stumps, and they often collapse from exhaustion. In order to force them on, handlers deliberately break their tails and rub tobacco and chili peppers into their eyes. And if one dies, he's skinned on the spot. It's the skin they want. It's the skin industry that is causing all of this. That's why the animals are going to slaughter. Once they arrive at these transport trucks that'll take them the final distance to their slaughter, many are sick and injured from this march. The law says that only 12 cattle can be put into one train car, but in reality, they shove 44, 45, up to 50 cattle inside these cars that should fit fit only 12. The law also says that only 4 cattle can be put on a truck, and they put dozens and dozens and dozens into one truck, and they break their limbs and they break their tails to make more room. And then they're driven over these rough, rough roads, and they're goring each other and they're trampling each other all the while. When they're unloaded, the cows who can still stand are pulled or forced to jump from the trucks, and they frequently break their legs and their pelvises in the process. Those who have collapsed are dragged from the vehicles, and other cows are just unloaded, you know, just to jump right on top of them. The cows' throats are slit in the slaughterhouse, and some have their legs cut off while they're still conscious. Others are skinned alive. The knives are rusty. The workers are callous. The workers are untrained. Butchers do not need to possess formal qualifications or training. In mechanized slaughterhouses, in certain places, boiling water is poured on the animal who's still alive, and his skin is stripped from him while he's still alive and hanging upside down. In Kerala, their heads are smashed in with a hammer, and sometimes it takes 20 blows before the animal dies. And many of these workers are children. And though some people in India do eat cattle meat, most of them don't. If they do eat meat, and there are a lot of Indians who do, they'll eat chicken, other kind of animals. So the fact is that millions of cattle that are jam-packed into these trucks and suffer all of this are doing so for the leather industry. So again, you have the case where these animals are suffering and dying only for their skin. What I find so unfortunate is that we hear about these victories from animal organizations who work to improve welfare in certain places, but we rarely hear the aftermath. For instance, you know, PETA has been working with the Indian government to improve standards for these cattle. And 6 years after their investigation into this industry and prompting the Indian government to promise to make improvements, the Indian government promised to make improvements in the transport and slaughter conditions endured by these animals. And PETA investigators have found virtually no improvements. The animals are still grotesquely abused in ways that violate Indian law, everything that I just described. That's why the best thing we can do is to cripple these industries by not buying these products. We need to remove the market for them. So that's the best thing we can do, in my opinion. These industries are going to use and abuse animals in any way they can. And if it means that it's whatever means is cheapest is what they're going to do. Welfare laws are barely enforced in the U.S., and they're barely enforced if they exist at all in other countries. So India and China is where most of the leather comes from. China is the world's leading exporter of leather. In addition to cattle and sheep and other animals who are turned into leather in China, it's estimated also that 2 million cats and dogs in China are killed for their skins each year, and they're confined to wire cages. They can barely move. These animals are routinely skinned alive. They're hacked apart piece by piece until they bleed to death. In France, more than 20,000 cats are stolen for the skin trade annually. So if the animal welfare standards are lower in other countries, you can bet your bottom dollar that the environmental standards are lower too. Many developing countries have been able to compete with the tanning industry of developed countries for that very reason. They have lower labor costs and they have less stringent environmental regulations. And like I said, developing countries account for a higher percentage of leather production than developed countries. The U.S. is not a leader in leather production at all. So if you think that you're just contributing to some U.S. slaughter industry that you think is okay, that's not the case, because China and India and Pakistan and Bangladesh capture 60% of the world's leather production. The leather industry is not a benign industry. And with low environmental regulations of leather production around the world, this is another major concern. Now, again, I have to back up because we have to consider the environmental cost of just the raising and killing of animals. I'm reluctant to use the word raising because it kind of evokes this maternal act of kindness. I would rather say keeping. The environmental cost of keeping and killing animals is huge, ranging from the use of precious resources such as water, the use of petroleum, the destruction of wild lands to clear it for livestock grazing, the deforestation, the pollution of waterways from waste runoff, off the emission of methane, which is the number one greenhouse gas that contributes to global warming. And wouldn't you know that grass-fed cattle emit more methane than corn-fed? Tell that to Michael Pollan next time he espouses the glories of grass-fed cattle. There's the intentional killing of millions of wild animals to stop them from competing with cattle. There's the huge amount of fossil fuels needed in livestock production. I mean, so on and so on. And this is in every country. This is in the United States. This is in all these developing countries where, you know, this kind of intensive farming is happening. So all of these environmental concerns are valid in the leather industry because you're starting with these factory farming practices in the meat industry. So you can't separate the two. So when you talk about the environmental cost of leather, you first have to start with the environmental cost of the meat industries. Does that make sense? And then we can talk about the toxins and the chemicals and all of the stuff that's used to preserve the skins of animals that would otherwise decompose very quickly, very naturally. The tanning process is an incredibly energy intensive and pollution producing process. In fact, tanneries are listed as top polluters on the Environmental Protection Agency's Superfund list. In the United States, this list identifies the most critical industrial sites in need of environmental cleanup. And because of their high toxic levels, many old tannery sites can't even be used for agriculture. They can't be built on. They can't even be sold. It's pretty bad. It's bad for the workers. It's bad for the people. It's bad for the people who live near these tanneries, who work in these tanneries. Bad for the rivers that ultimately collect these toxins from these tanneries. It's bad for the animals and the ecosystems affected by these toxins in the environment. And some of these hazardous chemicals are formaldehyde, coal tar derivatives, oils, dyes, cyanide-based finishing compounds. Other chemicals include alcohol, coal tar, degreasing agents, formic acid, lead, lime, resin builders, sodium chloride, sodium sulfate, sulfuric acid, waxes, and so on. Most leather production involves chromium tanning, which is considered hazardous by the EPA as well. People who work in and live near tanneries are dying of cancer caused by exposure to toxic chemicals used to process and dye the leather. A study conducted by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported that a solvent used in tanning leather appears to be associated with an increased risk of testicular cancer. They also found that the incidence of leukemia among residents in an area near one tannery in Kentucky was 5 times the U.S. average. Arsenic, a common tannery chemical, has long been associated with lung cancer in workers who are exposed to it on a regular basis. And studies of tannery workers in Sweden and Italy found cancer rates between 20 and 50% above those expected. And the energy that's involved in the leather making process is outrageous. So much energy that on the basis of quantity of energy consumed per unit produced, the leather manufacturing industry is categorized alongside the paper, steel, cement, and petroleum manufacturing industries as a gross consumer of energy. Now, again, aside from the energy that it takes to just keep and kill animals, the transportation, the petroleum, the water, all of that, if you start from the point at which the animal is killed, assuming, of course, hopefully that they are killed by the time they get skinned, here's a rough rundown of the steps involved in the leather industry, just so you have an idea of kind of how much is involved in tanning these skins and preserving them for a long, long time. So first, there's the skinning of the animal, the flaying of the animal. Then there's the hide curing. They have to cure the hide. They have to start stopping the decomposition right away. The fleshing, there's trimming, sorting, storing, shipping, spraying. So when they're shipping these hides to the place where they actually go through the tanning process, they have to spray them with pesticides because insects such as the larder beetle will destroy the hide. Then there's soaking and liming, which is also called dehairing. There's the splitting, deliming, baiting, pickling, tanning, wringing, trimming, splitting, shaving, retanning, coloring or dyeing, fat liquoring, staking, finishing, and platening. All of this is to make leather. So if we decide that we don't want to contribute to the leather and meat industry, what are our options? Now, there are a lot of options. And first of all, it's worth saying that some fabulous alternatives to leather are things like organic cotton, there's linen, there's bamboo, there's recycled rubber, rami canvas. So there's a whole bunch of natural materials that you can use instead of wearing leather or any of the synthetics at all. And I also think it's worth saying this. I know I hear this from people who are eating animals, who are wearing the skins of animals. One of the things that they do is immediately point to synthetic materials and the production of synthetic leather and say, well, all of the toxins in that is really bad. And so leather is a natural product and leather will biodegrade and it's in it. So hopefully I've given you enough information to assess the leather industry and see the toxins involved and the problems with the environmental problems and the ethical issues around animals, etc. But it's worth saying that in contrast to leather products, plastic wearables account for a fraction of the petroleum, for instance, used in the U.S. And though some plastics are better than others, and we can all reduce our consumption of plastic in general, the manufacturing of synthetic shoes doesn't even come close to the toxic output by the leather industry. So that's just food for thought, and you can do with that what you will. Now, one thing to look for when you're buying alternatives to leather is looking just for man-made materials. It will say man-made materials on the product. Now, unfortunately, sometimes you see man-made materials on the shoe, but then it says leather uppers, which is always annoying. And you can find man-made shoes in virtually every shoe store, from Macy's to Nine West to Birkenstock, New Balance, all of the hiking shoes, and there's a huge array of sneakers and running shoes that are not using leather these days. You can also check out stores like Payless. Well, you'll find a big selection of synthetic shoes. But if you want to get some better quality non-leather items and you want to support vegan businesses, conscious vegan businesses in the meantime, I recommend that you check out these fabulous stores on the internet. And beyond, actually, there's Moo Shoes, which is mooshoes.com, M-O-O-shoes.com, which also has a brick and mortar store in New York City. So you can go to mooshoes.com or you can go to their store in the city. One of the reasons Moo Shoes is also fantastic, and this goes for all of these other stores as well, is because all of the store suppliers are fair trade. They ensure that the workers get fair pay and that they're safe working conditions. None of the materials, down to the glues, obviously, are made from or tested on animals. So Moo Shoes and these other stores I'm going to recommend go to great lengths to get high quality ethical shoes. And they're really cute. They're really fashionable. And I know you can get cheap shoes in stores like Payless, and I'm not saying you can't do that, but the cost of something is not just found in dollars. So if you want to support, you know, kind of a better, higher conscious product, then I recommend checking out Moo Shoes. You can check out Alternative Outfitters and ditto with everything I said about the suppliers they work with to make sure that their suppliers, even outside of the US and Canada, are made under fair trade conditions. So alternativeoutfitters.com, also vegan owned. If I didn't mention that Moo Shoes is vegan owned, so is Alternative Outfitters. Super cute shoes and bags and wallets and accessories. And one that's in the UK, if you live outside of the US, Vegetarian Shoes and Bags. My first pair of vegan shoes was from this store a long time ago, before any other vegan stores were on the web. They're also vegan owned. They're based in England and they've been around for a long time. And again, they really ensure that they're getting very high ethical shoes. And so they've got fabulous things as well. There's even a little store in Oakland if you're local. It's called Micho Mambo, M-I-C-I-O Mambo. I believe it's michomambo.com. So it's M-I-C-I-O-M-A-M-B-O, Micho Mambo. And they're this wonderful vegan-owned little store in Oakland near the Grand Lake Theater. And they've got shoes and belts and candles and lots of other things. And I really encourage you to support these vegan businesses. Now, in terms of other non-leather materials, I know many people are trying to avoid PVC, polyvinyl chloride plastic, commonly known as vinyl, and manufacturing this material does involve toxins as well, which can cause a variety of health problems. So, you know, again, reducing our use of PVC is a good thing, but you can also get other kinds of plastic materials, and more companies are kind of replacing PVC. And look out for that in these shoes as well. Polyurethane is preferable to PVC plastic, and some companies are already phasing it out. Like I said, like IKEA and Microsoft and Nike are phasing out PVC. So, you know, everybody's kind of moving in that direction and getting a little more conscious. And in terms of what else to look for, you know, you've probably heard of micro suede or microfiber. It's a wonderful alternative to suede. It's a very popular material for couches, for sofas, and for apparel, and it's really easy to clean, so nobody had to die for that. So look for micro suede and microfiber. And other synthetics to look for, there's something called Vegetan, which is a microfiber material. It's created specifically to act as a vegan leather. There's Birkoflor, which is a proprietary material of Birkenstock, and it's made from acrylic and polyamide filled fibers, and it's a variation to replicate patent leather. There's Birkabuck, which is another proprietary material of Birkenstock. So if you didn't think Birkenstock had non-leather materials, you would be wrong. You could check out Birkenstock. I've got a couple pair of Birkenstock sandals that are vegan, obviously. And so they have this Birkabuck, which is made to look like nubuck leather. There's cork leather, which is a natural, renewable, and sustainable material made from the bark of cork oak trees. So you can look for that. And there's also something, this material called Lorica, which is 50% polyamide microfiber and 50% polyurethane. And it's imported from Italy. It's really breathable. It's permeable to water vapor. It's machine washable, stain resistant. It's another synthetic that you can look for. So I got nothing else to say right now. I do plan on doing other episodes focusing on the byproduct industry in general. So that's something to look forward to. I hope this was helpful for you. I know it can be frustrating because we want to do the right thing. There's so much we can do. There's just so much we can do. And it's really empowering to know that we can. So just starting to reduce the use of animal products in our culture would go a long way in helping animals, in reducing the environmental concerns that we have. And certainly it will help us reflect our own values. Because what is the point? What's the point of saying that we care about these things if we don't do anything to reflect those concerns? So my hope is that our daily choices, our daily purchases will be a reflection of our deepest values. For the animals, this is Colleen with Compassionate Cooks. Thanks for listening.